Welcome to this special audio highlights program of a CME satellite symposium held during the recent ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For the original meeting in Chicago, we gathered six faculty members on the stage. Four investigators in lymphoma, Drs. Michael Williams, Martin Dreiling, Jonathan Friedberg, and Michelle Fennell, and researchers in multiple myeloma, Drs. Sagar Lonial and Ken Anderson, to present cases from their practices to the audience, who were using networked iPads to answer related poll questions and to present their own cases and questions back to the faculty for discussion. For this highlights program, I met with three of these investigators to go back over the cases discussed in the meeting and the many questions posed by the audience that we didn't have time to address in the meeting. To begin, Dr. Friedberg comments on CLL, a topic he discussed, and T-cell lymphoma discussed by Dr. Fennell. Dr. Friedberg began by commenting on a patient he presented at the meeting.
So the initial presentation of this patient was an asymptomatic lymph node in the neck. And he noticed it. He was somebody who paid quite a bit of attention to his health. He has some other health problems as well, so he sees physicians relatively frequently. And he sought attention, and that led to a pretty quick biopsy.
And can you talk about what was seen and what you decided to do?
Right. So on the biopsy, what we saw was evidence of classic small lymphocytic lymphoma. There was no evidence of any transformation. He then was referred to me. And as part of the initial evaluation, his blood counts were normal, although he did have a mild lymphocytosis on the differential. And we did do additional imaging studies given the presentation of lymphadenopathy. And he had non-bulky lymphadenopathy throughout, including some mesenteric lymphadenopathy. And his spleen was at the upper limits of normal.
And what was his sort of life history? What was his lifestyle like and functioning level as a 79-year-old man? What kind of work did he do?
So he was a retired radiation therapist.
Wow.
He continued to be quite active in the community, volunteering at multiple types of venues, sitting on boards and that sort of thing.
And being not only a physician, but in the field of oncology, how was he with the idea of watch and wait?
I think he struggled with it. It's not necessarily a conversation I think that radiation therapists usually have with their patients. And although I think he knew inherently it was the appropriate thing to do from the research that he did, he struggled with the concept that it was okay if things progressed a bit and we didn't have to quickly intervene.
So he, in fact, I guess, went a couple years without any treatment.
That's right. I will say that similar to some other patients who initially struggle with the watch and wait concept, we saw him relatively frequently, and most of those visits were for reassurance. The other thing we did that we wouldn't necessarily do in every patient is a bone marrow biopsy, in part for his reassurance that there wasn't something else going on. And that allowed us to do some prognostication. And in his case, he had evidence of chromosome 13 deletion, which should predict for a more favorable prognosis. And he did, again, have no evidence of transformation.
So I guess the next time point was a couple years later when he ended up being in a situation where you thought he needed treatment.
Right. So over those couple of years, as expected, his lymphocyte count did go up. It did not double over the course of a few months, but clearly there was expected disease progression. And the real presentation that led to a discussion about treatment was growth of lymphadenopathy. He continued to have asymptomatic disease, but his lymph nodes were approaching the 5 to 6 centimeter range. And he became more uncomfortable at that point with the concept of observation.
So this occurred how long ago?
This was a few months ago that the initial appreciation of the progressive lymphadenopathy had occurred, and we've had discussions since over what the treatment would be.
And I think that you mentioned that you had started treatment.
Right. So he started on the clorambucil-obinutuzumab combination after a discussion of other options.
And what's his current situation? How long has he been treated?
He's really just started, so it's too early to assess outcome, although I can say that the tolerance of the combination has been quite good.
So we asked the audience how they would manage a patient like this. The faculty, I think, specifically Mike Williams, I was curious about his viewpoint. He also would have used obinutuzumab with chlorambucil in this patient, but the audience is a little bit split. And actually, the most common choice, as you might not be surprised, was bendamustine, rituximab. There were a few people, and I think you commented on this, who thought about fludarabine, rituximab, and I think you commented, maybe you can elaborate on that. There were a fair number of people, actually, who would use chlorambucil, obinutuzumab, about a quarter of the audience, but also about 15% would use chlorambucil, rituximab. So at the meeting, the faculty got into a bunch of things related to these answers, one being FR, is that appropriate in a 79-year-old? What's your answer?
So I feel pretty strongly that of all the answers, that one is the least appealing option. I think the balance of toxicity and efficacy is really not in the right direction in a 79-year-old. If you're going to give a 79-year-old a purine analog regimen, you really have to do a significant dose modification. GFR in most 79-year-olds is quite low, and the toxicity profile of purine analogs is substantial. And there are randomized trials that suggest there really is not a benefit to the purine analogs in the older patients like we see in younger patients. So particularly with bendamustine's availability, I think that would be last on my list.
How do you approach the issue of bendamustine anti-CD20 combination rituximab versus chlorambucil with anti-CD20 rituximab or obinutuzumab? How do you sort of choose between those kinds of options?
Well, I think we're obviously still learning. Obinutuzumab has only very recently been commercially available, and it's been studied specifically in combination with chlorambucil with quite appealing results from a single trial conducted in Germany. Before obinutuzumab's availability, I think the bendamustine rituximab combination would have been a very reasonable option for this patient. Some people might consider starting at a slightly lower dose, like at 70 milligrams per meter squared, just to modulate toxicity a bit as he's approaching age 80. I think that now some of this will be how patients like him do over the next year or so as far as which option is better. I don't think we have any randomized data to suggest that bendamustine is better or worse than chlorambucil obinutuzumab in this type of patient. And I think some of it is familiarity. But in his case, some of the decision was how much better the obinutuzumab seemed to do over rituximab in that randomized trial.
Yeah, I was kind of curious by the answer given by a small fraction, but not insignificant, of chlorambucil rituximab. And we also asked them in a poll question what their perception was in terms of efficacy. And there were actually quite a few people, to my surprise, who either kind of didn't know or thought they were about equivalent. Are they equivalent?
Well, if you had asked me that question before the results came out, I probably would have predicted they would be relatively equivalent. And up until this trial, studies that compared different anti-CD20 antibodies have been really few and far between. And those studies that have been done, including a phase 2 trial in non-Hodgkin lymphoma with obinutuzumab, single agent, comparing it to rituximab, there was really no difference in PFS. So the extent of the difference, which was substantial in this trial as far as progression-free survival, not only a statistically meaningful result, but I think a consensus opinion that this is a clinically meaningful improvement, was surprising. And it doesn't surprise me that there's a bit of a learning curve in the community on that.
What about combining obinutuzumab with other agents, specifically bendamustine or fludarabine cyclophosphamide?
Right. A great question. I think that's the direction that is an obvious one as far as where to go for investigation. Outside of a clinical trial, at this point, I would be very uncomfortable doing that, in part because there are some early clinical trial results that suggest an increased toxicity profile And particularly for a vulnerable patient like this one, I think you'd be potentially setting yourself up for seeing neutropenias and things that you might not expect. But we will be learning more about those types of combinations, both in non-Hodgkin lymphoma as well as in CLL over the next months to years.
I guess the thing that I've heard about, and I'm not sure what quantitatively sort of what it means, is infusion reactions. First of all, how many doses has this man gotten so far, and has he had any problems?
So he's really just started, and in cycle one, he did not have a problem. However, what I can say is that in our experience in the clinical trials, which were more in non-Hodgkin lymphoma than CLL, but I wouldn't expect it would be too different. In my mind, without a question, there are more infusion reactions with this antibody. And the first dose, in fact, is split per the label, in part recognizing the fact that you really have a hard time getting the dose in one day due to these infusion reactions. Similar to rituximab, after the first cycle, it's tolerated very well, and it's really not been a repeated problem in my experience. But I think oncologists who have gotten quite accustomed to managing rituximab-associated toxicities will certainly be able to manage this, but they should expect that it's going to be more frequent and perhaps slightly more severe during that first infusion.
So moving more towards younger patients in CLL, you presented another patient, a 67-year-old family physician, so you had a couple of docs there as patients that you presented. And during the course of his disease, a 17p deletion was detected. But I was curious, and we also asked the audience, how you would have approached him today if this man presented with a 17p deletion.
If he were to have presented with it, which is only about 5 to maybe 10% of CLL, but in most estimations, about 5% of CLL will walk in the door with a deletion of 17p. What we know is that standard chemotherapy doesn't work particularly well, and you have a harder time achieving remission, and those remissions are less durable. The recommendations have been to use standard type approaches like FCR chemotherapy, if somebody could tolerate it, and consider an early consolidation with transplant. I think many of us have had poor experience with standard chemotherapy and feel somewhat excited about observations in the relapse setting where strategies like ibrutinib, alemtuzumab, and lenalidomide all seem to have activity in this situation. And a single-arm study of ibrutinib showed a very high response rate. And I think the key question there is, if somebody responds well to ibrutinib, do they even need to proceed to an allogeneic transplant? This would be the uncommon situation where I might even consider an upfront ibrutinib intervention or plan to move very quickly to ibrutinib at first sign that chemotherapy was not as active as one would hope.
It's interesting, the audience was kind of split between three choices, FCR, BR, and ibrutinib. Have you actually been able to administer ibrutinib up front? Can you access it?
I have not had the situation that you describe. Most of the patients that come into our referral clinic are patients where we detect the deletion 17 after they've failed prior therapy. So I have not been confronted with this decision myself yet. I would say, though, that there is enough data out there in phase two situations that I would be confident that one could get that by many insurance companies if they wanted to.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about, and kind of related to this, well, first of all, I don't know, when I look at the small molecule inhibitors like ibrutinib, there's adalimumab and the ABT compound, to me, it seems like when it's been looked at, and even the other biologics, I'm not sure how much has been looked at, like lenalidomide, it doesn't seem like there's that much difference in response based on 17P or not. Is that your take?
The difference is much less. I will say that if you look at the progression-free survival curves and you take the deletion 17 patients and separate them out from everyone else, there are somewhat more failures that are occurring, say, between year one and year two, but the curve is still well above 50%. It's not crashing down or anything like that. So I think that it's still likely going to evolve to be a marker of relatively inferior outcome. But you're absolutely correct that the dramatic differences that we see in the chemotherapy platforms are just not there with these new interventions.
Sort of related to that also was the paper presented at ASH comparing BR to FCR. What's your take on that? And what about, again, in the adverse cytogenetic situation?
In younger patients, the conclusion of that study that I think most of us have drawn is that certainly BR wasn't better and there was some inferiority to BR compared to FCR. However, BR was better tolerated. And I think that in an incurable disease like CLL, you have to factor in tolerability and efficacy and make a decision on an individual patient basis. My interpretation is that my default strategy for most younger patients remains FCR. However, BR is clearly an active regimen, and if there's concern about tolerating a purine analog-containing regimen for some reason, I think that BR is an acceptable alternative.
So this man had a long and complicated course, but the bottom line is that after multiple treatments, he went on a BTK inhibitor. Actually, it was an experimental one that is not available. What happened when he got that treatment?
So when I met him prior to enrolling on that clinical trial, he was coming off of bendamustine and rituximab in combination, where he was really quite refractory. And despite this, he was continuing to practice medicine, but clearly he was getting tired and had bulky lymphadenopathy and cytopenias that were near requiring transfusion. And what's happened has been quite remarkable. He's been on the treatment now, similar to what you'd see with ibrutinib, for about 14 months, and he's had an excellent response. He still has some very small lymphadenopathy, but they've continued to shrink in time. He had the expected lymphocytosis that you see with these agents transiently that has resolved, and he feels great. We've had discussions with him about whether it's time to think about proceeding to an allogeneic transplant or not. He does not have a sibling donor, and his decision is to keep going on this treatment. I think the one thing I'll say is looking ahead in somebody like him is what happens if he progresses. And we have had some experience where patients who have progressed on a BTK inhibitor will respond to a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor and vice versa. So I think there's going to be some opportunity to sequentially expose patients to these various small molecules, and that even in the setting of progressive disease on ibrutinib, there may be other options in the future.
You also talked about in the symposium the other small molecule inhibitors. You mentioned adalimumab as well as the ABT compound. If you specifically just focus on CLL, any way to sort of indirectly compare these agents? Would you expect a combination might be better? How do you see the data right now?
Well, I think it's really quite challenging to compare these agents even indirectly. I think that the database on the ABT compound is quite limited. Those who have used it have told me that they feel it may be the best of the three, but it's a very small number of patients. I think there's been some enthusiasm given the degree of tumor lysis that's been seen that it suggests that this is just a very, very active agent. So I think that it's really too early to make any comparisons. And given ibrutinib's more substantial track record and study, it's likely that's going to be the first choice for many for at least a period of time. Regarding your question on combinations, without question, that is the direction that a lot of us want to go. I will provide a cautionary tale of a data set that we presented at ASCO that combined a novel SYK inhibitor with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, idelalisib. And we had to close that study early due to the appearance of fatal pneumonitis in a few patients. This was a toxicity we didn't expect. Pneumonitis has not been described with the SYK inhibitor alone, and with idelalisib, it's extremely uncommon and generally not this severe.
How many cases did you see?
So in that study, there were 8 patients who developed some degree of pulmonary symptomatology. And we had 2 deaths from pneumonitis. And having cared for some of these patients, it was humbling, I think, for us, because it was something we didn't expect. And when the first patient developed it, we really were sure it was an infection because the patient was so heavily pretreated. But there does appear to be a characteristic signal, and we're going back and doing some extensive cytokine analysis and so forth to see if we can understand it better. I don't think that the message is that it was a wrong thing to try, but I think that we have to be very careful in our approach that these agents seem to be relatively non-toxic when given as single agents. Proper phase 1 studies and controlled clinical trials are really going to be necessary to determine safety of these combinations.
That's a really good point in general in oncology. I want to ask you some questions that were sent in through the iPads from attendees at the conference. There were several cases that are sort of variants of this in terms of heterogeneity of adverse findings. 43-year-old patient just diagnosed with CLL. White count of 60,000, 8% of the cells with 17p deletion. Doubling time of 4 months with 60,000 currently, stage 1, mild B symptoms, when to treat and with what. Note, she's been evaluated for allotransplant with recommendation to have it in second remission. Is FCR still the standard of care in CLL considering all the long-term toxicities and given the new agents? And I'm particularly interested about how you interpret it when you only have part of the cells expressing an adverse factor.
So I would worry if you see as many as 8% of cells expressing deletion of 17, that that's going to be the subset that is resistant to treatment and that that number will grow over time. It's not uncommon to see this type of heterogeneity. Some of it is also how you look for this. If you're using conventional cytogenetics or FISH, and if you're using FISH, you can look at a larger number of cells to really get a sense as to what the percentage is. Regarding treatment for a patient like this, I think that many would say that still the default is FCR, although trying to incorporate novel agents is clearly appealing. I should remind the audience that the U.S. Intergroup is currently conducting a randomized trial of FCR versus ibrutinib and rituximab as upfront treatment in CLL. I've enrolled a patient on that study. It was an interesting discussion, but this patient was very motivated, wanted ibrutinib, and I said this was his chance. He ended up getting it, so he's very happy.
Wow.
And I think that study and others like it will define whether we're going to be able to move these agents up front or not. And outside of trials like that, I think it is more complicated, although in the setting of deletion of chromosome 17, as we said earlier, it may be the one scenario where trying to do something like this up front makes sense.
So we got really a lot of great cases, a bunch of them with adverse cytogenetics, which you already talked about. Here's one I like. I always like it when it starts off with, I have an 87-year-old. Poor cytogenetic CLL, has been on ibrutinib times 6 weeks, so here's that situation, but developed AFib after 2 weeks, now having problems with CHF, recent GI bleed, but the patient's having a great response to ibrutinib. It's been held with all this stuff going on. Cardiology thinks it should not be restarted. Any thoughts about ibrutinib in the heart?
I think that in general, ibrutinib has not been typically associated with heart problems. There are some issues with ibrutinib about bleeding, however, that have been reported, and whether the GI bleed is somehow related is unclear. I think the other issue is often patients with atrial fibrillation end up on anticoagulation,
right?
And that's a relative contraindication to ibrutinib, at least at this point, given the fact that some hematomas, subdurals, and so forth were observed in the early studies with ibrutinib, and all the subsequent studies have really not taken patients that have been on anticoagulation. So that's a complicated area. On the other hand, you know, this patient could end up dying of their CLL, and I think this is the art of medicine in choosing which toxicity you're going to accept. In a patient like this, if you are going to avoid ibrutinib, I think my next choice would likely be lenalidomide in very low dose. And it may be something that could be tolerated better, and you wouldn't have to worry about the risks associated with anticoagulation.
What about adalimumab and ABT, assuming you could get him in a trial? Would they be eligible, or would he be eligible? Would you want to give it? Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I think idelalisib would be quite interesting. The bleeding has not been associated with idelalisib. So I think that that drug in particular would be quite appealing if you could get him on a trial.
You know, just as a very, very distant observer of all the FDA stuff and cost stuff and all that, sometimes I wonder whether adalimumab would be approved and on the market today if there wasn't ibrutinib. Does that make any sense? Do you think there's enough data that it really kind of ought to be available?
Well, I think they are looking at different strategies and different indications. I think the NHL data that they presented is a different scenario from the way ibrutinib went forward. No question, they're both active agents. We've used both of them, and I hope that it will be approved because my sense is, as I said earlier, that sequencing these agents and, as you implied, potentially combining agents like this is a very appealing option. And the more of these agents that we're going to have available, I think ultimately the better for patients.
Here's one we get every now and then. 80-year-old with CLL, is bone marrow required?
So the official recommendation is no, that you can make a diagnosis of CLL on the blood with an appropriate immunophenotype, and bone marrow may not necessarily add to your decision-making, particularly if you do cytogenetic analysis on the blood.
How do you manage dose reduction of bendamustine in older patients, and does bendamustine affect overall survival in CLL?
The first question is that generally patients, if they're very old and frail, I might start at a dose of 70 milligrams per meter squared rather than a dose of 90 milligrams per meter squared. I generally don't go any higher than 90 milligrams per meter squared. Some of the earlier studies were done with 100 milligrams per meter squared. If the 70 isn't tolerated, you could go down to 60. But if you go much lower than that, I don't think that you're giving enough activity and you have to think of alternative strategies. Regarding whether it improves overall survival, there really hasn't been substantial evidence that chemotherapy in and of itself affects overall survival. The addition of rituximab to the FC regimen did show an overall survival benefit. But bendamustine versus other chemotherapy, that question hasn't been addressed.
So we actually got a couple of questions about R maintenance in CLL, which I kind of thought was a done deal, so to speak, in terms of not using it. But anyhow, patient with CR after 4 cycles of FCR, no significant toxicity from treatment, role of maintenance after excellent rapid response. Another one, 55-year-old with radiographic and hematologic CR, residual microscopic disease in the marrow after FCR, and, quote, has been on rituximab maintenance for 3 years. How long should it be continued? So what about this issue?
Well, I agree with your initial point that there really aren't studies that suggest there's any benefit to rituximab maintenance. Rituximab as a single agent in CLL has such limited activity that one might predict that it's not going to be sufficiently active. And I would say in both of these cases, there's no role for maintenance.
And, you know, one other thing I was going to ask you about, we were talking about obinutuzumab, which is, you know, I think you mentioned the fact that it was surprising to a lot of people that there was so much difference between the two anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies. Now that you've had a chance to sort of think it through for a while, and I think also the issue of the dose that was used came up, but do you feel like there's enough of a difference in sort of the mechanism of how these two antibodies work that that could explain, you know, such a big difference?
It was a certain defined scenario where the study was done. We have to put that in mind. It was this scenario of CLL where the single agent activity of rituximab is extremely low. So it's certainly beatable compared to, say, follicular lymphoma, where single-agent rituximab is quite active. It was joined with chemotherapy, but a relatively gentle and not overly efficacious chemotherapy. So I think those two points can't be emphasized enough. So if you were setting up a scenario where the obinutuzumab was going to shine, you did have a pretty good scenario here upon reflection. I have to say, I think that CLL is different from NHL in the way these antibodies work. I think the fact that rituximab doesn't work well in CLL is evidence of that. And I now appreciate better the concept that a type 2 antibody in this setting is simply a better choice.
So let's move on and spend the rest of our time talking about T-cell lymphoma that Michelle Fennell presented. So she presented a patient. It's actually a very inspiring story because it's a 51-year-old man in the military in Afghanistan who I guess was diagnosed with ALCL ALK negative disease and received brentuximab vedotin. And she was telling the story about how, you know, he ended up going for transplant. He's in remission. He's back in Afghanistan, which is pretty amazing. But can you talk a little bit about where we are today with ALCL and particularly about where brentuximab vedotin is fitting in?
So brentuximab vedotin, of course, is an anti-CD30 conjugated monoclonal antibody, and as a single agent has a very high response rate in that disease in the relapse setting. The response rate is about 80%. About half of those responses are complete responses, and particularly for patients who obtain complete response, they seem to be quite durable, and updates of that data that led to the approval of that agent in this indication have suggested that some of these patients can enjoy years of remission.
Just to backtrack a little bit on the biology, what do we know about CD30 and ALCL in terms of number of tumors that stain, the intensity of staining? It's known to be much more part of the pathogenesis than perhaps other tumors. And how does it compare, for example, to Hodgkin lymphoma from that perspective of CD30?
Well, CD30 almost by definition is positive in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And similarly with Hodgkin lymphoma, the density of staining is somewhat heterogeneous. And I think the correlation between the density of staining and response has not been demonstrated. But in these two histologies, they're almost always positive by definition, and the response rates of this agent are quite high. I think what you may be getting at is an observation that in some other T-cell histologies where CD30 is present maybe 20% of the time, the observation was first made that brentuximab has quite high efficacy in those patients. And then some patients were studied who were actually CD30 negative, and there was still some evidence of response. And I can tell you my own anecdote of a patient who has transformed mycosis fungoides. A young patient, he went through a great deal of initial treatments. Ultimately, he had no allogeneic donor, and in remission, he was consolidated with an autologous transplant. And within a few months of that, he had recurrent disease, progressed through romidepsin and some of the other agents. And in the setting of bulky adenopathy, we looked very carefully, and maybe 1 in 100 cells were CD30 positive. But given the lack of other options, we gave him brentuximab, and he's on his way to a complete response. I don't know how durable that will be. We're still looking for some allogeneic consolidation options. But without question, this agent works in ways that we may not understand. And I think there are two explanations. One is that our ability to detect CD30 may be limited, and subclinical expression or expression that we're not able to detect may be enough for this antibody to work. The other concept is that we may be affecting the microenvironment in important ways by killing non-malignant cells with this antibody that can also result in responses. So I think the observation is real. I think this goes beyond anecdotes. And I know the company is quite eager to try to figure out which of these hypotheses is correct. And by using more sophisticated ways of measuring CD30 on the surface of these cells, we may be able to understand it better.
Yeah, I think there was a data set from Madeline Duvick looking at MF and B vedotin, and it was kind of hard to figure out what CD30, how it figured in, because I think there were people like yours, patients who were responding without classic positive CD30.
That's right. And again, I think it's one of these two options, is maybe both as far as what explains that phenomenon.
So I want to ask you a question about toxicity, bevacizumab, but first I'm going to say two things and see whether you agree or disagree. Bevacizumab is the most active single agent we have in Hodgkin lymphoma.
I agree for systemic agents. Radiation is probably the most active agent.
Okay, systemic agents. Bevacizumab is the most active systemic agent we have in ALCL.
Agree.
Yeah, it's just kind of hard to put it in perspective after coming out of a chemotherapy world, but I just thought I'd throw that in there. In terms of toxicity, we asked a poll question about toxicity to see whether people had heard about the report related to pancreatitis, and it kind of looks like they haven't. What do we know right now about not just the sort of initial things we heard about toxicity like peripheral neuropathy, but these other less common problems such as pancreatitis?
Well, I'll first just mention the neuropathy, which is clearly real, and that's something that people will see. Neuropathy occurs with this agent. It tends to be seen more as you have higher cumulative doses of the agent. So it's uncommon to see neuropathy after cycle one, but maybe after cycle 4 to 6, you see it evolve. And I think it has to be taken very seriously. I had one patient on the pivotal trial that at that point I wasn't appreciating the neuropathy risk as much, and he had enough neuropathy that he was transiently in a wheelchair, recovered after stopping the drug. But clearly, one has to follow the dose modification guidelines and talk to patients before each dose.
And pancreatitis.
Regarding the pancreatitis, pancreatitis was described initially in a clinical trial. And then subsequently, through MedWatch and so forth, there were a few cases that were gathered together. I think this is a very uncommon toxicity with this drug. And I think people need to be aware that if a patient on this drug has abdominal pain, that they should have a low threshold to check pancreatic enzymes and so forth. But it certainly doesn't dissuade me from using the drug in all the scenarios where it's appropriate, given the efficacy that's been described.
Yeah, I was just interested in this idea that the normal pancreas has CD30 on it.
Yeah, that's been speaking to Andy Evans and so forth, who's been one of the people who initially noticed this toxicity and subsequently has been interested in it. That's a potential explanation as far as what has caused this. Again, I think we really don't understand it well, because we should appreciate that this is truly a group of anecdotal cases, a handful of cases, and it's not something that is occurring at a frequency enough that would change even some of the large trials studying this upfront. And maybe I'll mention it right now that there is a international randomized trial looking at CHOP chemotherapy compared with CHP chemotherapy with vincristine out and brentuximab in anaplastic large cell CD30 positive lymphoma.
And that's what I'm doing if I ever get in that situation, for sure, unless I can afford to buy the bevacizumab. So if you feel really brave, I'll start throwing out a bunch of T cell lymphoma questions that we got from the audience. We'll start out with something basic. A 20-year-old with ALCL, CHOP or CHOEP?
So anaplastic large cell lymphoma tends to be quite responsive to a variety of regimens. I think if this were ALK-positive disease, CHOP is clearly adequate. If it's ALK-negative disease, those patients tend to do a little bit less well. I would very much favor the trial that I mentioned. Outside of the trial, either is a reasonable option. I still generally use CHOP chemotherapy, although some people have felt, based on some German data, that CHOEP may be a bit better.
And right underneath that, we have a newly diagnosed patient, younger patient with PTCL. Would you recommend CHOP or something more aggressive?
I have been treating these patients with CHOP, but in a younger patient, unless they're ALK positive, I consolidate with autologous stem cell transplantation.
Right. Patient with PTCL and bone marrow involvement and pancytopenias and huge spleen. What first-line treatment would you give, and would you give growth factors in view of the splenomegaly?
I think you'd have to start with standard chemotherapy, anticipating that during cycle one, you're going to need to transfuse. And absolutely, I would give growth factors if the patient is starting with pancytopenia.
patient with TCL that only had a PR, doesn't say to what, but let's say it was CHOP, and is not a transplant candidate. Would you go to romidepsin or another systemic therapy, or just wait and treat on progression?
I would wait and treat on progression. I think that if the patient isn't a transplant candidate, you're clearly in palliative mode. And I think sometimes these diseases can behave in a rather indolent way. I think your choices, though, at time of progression could include romidepsin, pralatrexate, single-agent gemcitabine is another attractive option. You can go back and give drugs like doxorubicin. There are a lot of options that you could use.
Young woman with Sézary syndrome, massive adenopathy, and symptomatic skin involvement who's failed topicals, ONTAC, HDAC inhibitors. Treatment, recommendations?
I think clearly clinical trial would be an option. I think that I'd be worried in that situation about transformation, given the bulky lymphadenopathy. And if that's the case, I think frequently you have to think about chemotherapy.
19-year-old patient with ALK-positive ALCL, weight loss, high LDH, PET avid, splenomegaly. Had CHOP times 3, after cycle 4 has progressive disease with skin lesions, symptomatic CNS involvement, for which the patient got a radiation therapy. What's next? Any role for crizotinib?
Wow. I will say that shouldn't really happen. ALK-positive ALCL generally has a very good prognosis, and in a 19-year-old, I would be very careful about making sure I understood what the histology was and rebiopsy and make sure you're not missing something like ALL. But if this truly is what was described, I think that at that age, the goal has to be to consider trying to get this patient to an allogeneic transplant, and tools that you could use could include brentuximab or crizotinib, neither of which has certainly been studied in CNS disease, but at this point, you could try anything.
Have you yourself, I mean, it seems like there's only been, I don't know, a couple dozen cases reported with crizotinib, at least that I've seen. Have you ever used it? And is it more than a couple dozen cases?
No, I have not. We had one patient, not my primary patient, but one of my colleagues, who had a patient who progressed on brentuximab and was referred for a crizotinib trial. This was before the drug was even approved. And he had a great response and was able to get onto an allogeneic transplant. So I have seen it done, but I haven't directly cared for such a patient.
You know, in our lung cancer programs, we're talking all the time about the new ALK inhibitors that are out that seem to have a much greater spectrum and, you know, really exciting. One just got approved a couple weeks ago. Do you know whether or not these second generation, third generation ALK inhibitors being looked at in ALCL?
I don't know, but given how well brentuximab works, I mean, you have a very limited patient population, I think, to study, and it's likely for the time being these are going to be anecdotes unless some of the development strategy is broad enough where a trial in lung cancer might include a ALK-positive ALCL. Keep in mind that ALK-positive disease is curable disease for many patients with chemotherapy alone. So the subset of patients that you're dealing with who have relapsed disease is a small subset.
Here's another one. I have a patient who failed CHOP and ICE and is now on a pralatrexate with good response. I think this is PTCL. What's the regimen of choice should the patient progress on the pralatrexate? If I stop the pralatrexate and the patient's in remission and the patient recurs, can I use it again?
So yeah, I think you certainly could use it again if there was sufficient durability to warrant that. I think if you stop it and within a month it comes back, that's less appealing. But if you saw durability, I think using it again is fine. I think outside of that scenario, you can go down that list of options we talked about before, drugs like gemcitabine, romidepsin, vorinostat, and those types of agents. And brentuximab, as we discussed, even irrespective of the CD30 status.
Cutaneous TCL, CD30 positive, also has CLL, which is stable. Methotrexate, not effective. Can you treat with brentuximab?
Sure. I would see no reason why not. I think you have to make a decision on how important it is to treat. I mean, rituximab is expensive therapy, and if it's truly just cutaneous disease, there may be some less aggressive options, topical options and so forth, that should be tried first.
Speaking about pralatrexate, we also asked the audience how they usually sequence pralatrexate and romidepsin, the two most recently approved agents, and it sort of seemed to fall into, if we presented a case where the patient was symptomatic, it looks like the audience is a little more likely to use pralatrexate. If they're asymptomatic, they seem more likely to use romidepsin. Is that sort of the general way you approach that?
I almost always favor romidepsin first, given some personal experience feeling that the efficacy might be slightly higher and the toxicity is clearly lower. However, these have not been compared. I would not fault anybody who had some other metric as far as these. It's really unfortunate that the response rates of all of these agents are as low as they are, and that we have no good way of predicting. And it's frustrating. You try one, then you try the next thing, and we'd like to be in a different place in oncology now in this area. So I think one cannot be at all dogmatic about the appropriate sequence of those two.
A lot of questions about when to initiate systemic therapy in various cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. Here's one question. Patient with recurrent cutaneous anaplastic large cell lymphoma with multiple recurrences treated with local therapies. At what point do we think about systemic treatment?
Well, that's an individualized decision. That's a disease that very rarely becomes systemic. So I think a lot of it is how much it bothers the patient. Are there cosmetic issues and so forth? And you have to weigh risks and benefits. It's unlikely that you're going to cure that patient with systemic treatment. So systemic treatment is a tool that can be used, but I think that sometimes people are after a remission and you end up exposing the patients to a lot of aggressive treatment without any clear change in the natural history of the disease.